The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name's Rachel Smith. I'm CEO at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be back in the hosting seat for the first time in what feels like years. So forgive me if there's some botched slip-ups along the way. But in order to help me in my quest to make a decent show of this podcast, I have together with me today two fantastic guests, starting with ExchangeWire's Head of Content, John Still. Hello, John.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you for having me. Nice to have switched roles for this week.
I know, it's a bit weird, isn't it? I'm enjoying it though. And then our very special guest this week is Richard Hayter, Group Creative Director from Iris. Hello, Richard.
Hello to both of you. How lovely to be here.
Thank you for joining us.
We're very delighted to have you, yeah. And I wondered, Richard, if we could just kick off with you introducing for our listeners Iris. My understanding is sort of creative marketing agency, but tell us in your own words and explain a little bit about what you do there.
Yeah, well, you're 100% right. That's who we are. We are a global network, and we try and turn our clients into what we call participation brands. We've recognized that the time when brands could just tell everyone what they wanted to know is gone, and there are so many ways that you can invite your audience and your customers to interact with you now. That's what we try to do for all of our client brands, like Samsung, like Wacom, like Adidas.
Amazing. And do you work with a roster of sort of mostly big global clients, or do you also do some small, maybe sort of, you know, I'm going to say internet first, direct to consumer style client brands?
Yeah, we've got a really wide client base globally. We've got B2B crypto finance in San Francisco, along with people like PayPal. We've got startup banks in Singapore. We've got consumer electronics and running and football and hiking over in London. So it's a very, very diverse range of brands and customers that we talk to.
Amazing. That makes you perfectly qualified to discuss the news stories that we've got coming up on the podcast this morning. Okay, so kicking off with our first news story, which is that US watchdog group Check My Ads is filing a complaint with the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, claiming that X, formerly Twitter, has rolled out a new advertising format that isn't properly labeled and means that posts aren't disclosed as advertising. This adds to a pretty turbulent year for X since Elon Musk acquired it just a little over 12 months ago, during which time the company's been heavily criticised for the way that they deal with misinformation, false claims, and in particular hate speech, where they've significantly reduced their staff numbers that deal with that part of the business. Well, reduced, I should say, sacked them all. That's made advertisers increasingly nervous about how they might approach advertising on the platform. Added to that, there are some other recent developments that we've been reading about in the news this week concerning X, which is that their current CEO, Linda Yaccarino, not long been in post herself and has had a really strong track record with big global advertisers there in the US in her previous roles, is now being encouraged by some of those peers across those large advertisers to step down. And that can only really add to the landscape that advertisers are becoming more and more nervous about advertising on X. Clearly, a complaint like this that's being brought forward by an organization like Check My Ads says a lot about not only the advertising format that X has just introduced, but the potential nervousness with which advertisers might approach the platform from here onwards. But my question to both of you is, how much of an impact do you think this sort of activity will have on advertisers? Is it going to increase those levels of nervousness around transparency and the ability that advertisers have got to control where their ads are appearing on platforms like X? And then also, do you think this sort of activity will actually have an impact on the way that Elon Musk, Linda Yaccarino, and others are running and organizing the advertising business at X? I'm going to come to you for first comment on this, Richard. What do you think?
Oh, Elon. I mean, X is running out of feet in which to shoot itself, right? Elon's only doing this because he can, right? And the FTC, as you know, they'll be too slow to do anything about it. And he'll get away with it for a year, and he'll have an effect on the next US election, and it will turn X into even more of a mess than it is right now in the name of what he calls free speech, which he has demonstrated is only free speech as long as you agree with him. If I were the CMO of any brand that was publicly listed, I would run a million miles away from advertising on X, and I would be pulling my budget really quickly, particularly in the US, because I think that there's a kind of ripple effect. It starts in the States and then comes across the rest of the world. So it hasn't really hit the UK quite as much, I don't think, yet, what the impact of this kind of approach. But yeah, I wouldn't be advertising on X, and I would be looking at some other tech bros to put my money into, I think. At least Meta kind of give the impression that they care about what their audience are exposed to, whereas X doesn't really seem to anymore.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that as well, because I think this news article raised that there are some other advertising platforms that are now advertising on X, whereas, you know, Twitter used to only do those deals directly with advertisers. Yeah. So we're now in a position where advertisers are not just perhaps concerned about what's ending up on X, but concerned about the budgets that are going to other platforms such as Google that might then be transferring that money over to advertising elsewhere.
And there are issues with that as well. I mean, you know, there have been a number of people that are concerned about where their ads are set, what their ads are sat next to, I think is increasing across all of those channels. So I think it's grown beyond the control of all of the platforms, I think. That's certainly the way it looks. But as an advertiser, you can't ignore these platforms. They are just too big now. It would have been like ignoring TV in the 80s. You just couldn't do it. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of beads of sweat and hand wringing amongst CMOs, I think, until all of this kind of settles down or X collapses into itself and just goes away.
John, what do you think? Is X going to collapse into itself and go away?
I mean, I've said a lot on the podcast that I won't call it X, that I still wish to call it Twitter. And
it's a good disclaimer.
Well, I rescind it completely. Twitter was a place that was good for journalists, for good for news stories in its early days, and you know, had its use. But X is this new thing that is a dreadful place to be. It's awful. Elon, whatever he's tried to do with it, Richard made a good point about his definition of free speech, and he's, you know, claiming that companies like Disney, IBM, Warner Brothers, Lionsgate, NBC, Sony, who have all paused advertising spend on the platform and have seen the numbers crash since Elon took over. Free speech is also means that you don't have to spend money on a platform. It's not denying anyone free speech. It is just making a choice of where not to put your ad spend, because you don't want to end up next to inflammatory, hateful material that is not only, you know, sneaks onto the platform, is openly promoted by its owner. It's a horrible state of affairs for something. You know, Twitter had its issues. It was always a forum that, you know, there was debate and bad material that snuck onto it, but X it's something different. So yeah, I will be calling it X from now on, and it is not the Twitter that I used to know and love. It's a sad state of affairs, but yeah, this, and people are pulling their dollars, and we're seeing where the financials are going. So it's, yeah, just I don't know where it ends, but yeah, Richard could be right in terms of the death spiral it's facing.
And I mean, you raised an interesting point there, Richard, and you sort of, it picks up on something, on a few things that you've just said there as well, John, which is perhaps Elon Musk is creating this environment deliberately to fulfill some political ambitions, and it will roll on like this until a year's time when there's a presidential election. And in the meantime, he doesn't really care very much what happens, certainly not with revenue. The advertising revenue can't be important to him given the numbers that we see. So he's obviously just, you know, I don't know, bankrolling it from his, what, you know, from his Tesla profits or something. So what do you think about that? What do you think about that, John? And what do you think that does to advertisers as well? Because, you know, it's a double-edged sword. As you mentioned, Richard, some of these platforms are huge and you can't afford not to advertise on them. And it's a big advertising year in the coming 12 months leading up to an election. John, do you see some advertisers kind of, I don't know, proceeding with caution, or do you see them really just pulling back?
I think the word paused in their advertising rather than stopped, cancelled, was telling. I think that leaves the conversation open for change and for a return when maybe things have settled down. We are in incredibly divisive times at the moment, and you know, advertisers are stepping back and proceeding with caution in terms of brand safety. So it wouldn't surprise me to see some companies edging spend back towards X, if it remains a viable platform. I'd like to see them withhold it until problems are solved, until, you know, someone who understands it really is in charge of it. And I know Linda Yaccarino's had a very hard job in convincing people to spend, but she's doubled down on it this week. She said, in light of all this, you know, the calls for her to resign and step away and, you know, be the good guy in the situation, she's doubled down and said, nope, she's in it for the long haul. So I don't know. Yeah, paused was interesting rather than stopped. So open-ended, we'll see. But it's a hard sell for advertisers to want to go back, I think.
Richard, what do you think on that?
I think a couple of things. John hit on a point earlier when he said that it was great for journalists, and I think that is almost entirely why Twitter punched above its weight in terms of influence, because it was the first place that celebrity and journalists went to get breaking news, and then it's always been much more influential than its numbers would suggest, than its actual subscribers and active users would suggest, and that felt like a really great basis for Elon to build his original vision for what he wanted X to be, which is his everything app, which is, you know, like one of the Chinese multi-purpose apps where you bank on it and you shop on it and you get your news from it and you run your community through it, a combination of WhatsApp and your banking app and everything all rolled into one. But I think for X to become that, people need to feel they can trust it. And I think everything that Elon is doing right now is eroding that ability to trust X because of him. He is so visible behind it as well. And, you know, being called out as supporting anti-Semitic tweets is not going to help if you want people to give your banking details to it. So
100%.
I don't really understand what his end game is now, but he'd probably tell me it's because I'm not bright enough.
This is it. I mean, you know, from the average IQ person's point of view, I'm talking about myself here, it just looks like he can't get out of his own way. Like it just seems like a ridiculous strategy to try to endear yourself to people. And as you said, Richard, there would have to be a whole other level of trust in order for people to start completing the sorts of transactions that they do in super utility apps in Asia on a platform like X. And I can't see that coming forwards to Elon Musk. You know, Kara Swisher did a fantastic podcast, one of her pivot podcasts a little while ago, about the insanity of Elon Musk. She's interviewed him over the years, and she's, you know, she's a journalist herself, obviously, and she did this really interesting sort of hour-long expose on the acceleration of his madness in tandem with the acceleration of his political ambitions. And her point of view and those of the people that she interviewed is one of all of this public-facing stuff around Tesla even and X is just sort of small time activity for him. Actually, his larger ambitions are influencing political outcomes. Mm-hmm. And you know, that might explain why he then can't help but just be Mr. Prominent all the time. But you're absolutely right. Who the hell would give him their banking details? I mean, you know, not in a month of bloody hot summers would I do that. It's just unbelievable, right? Yeah, you know, I barely trust some of the incumbent big tech, you know, American big tech platforms with my data. Why would I trust him? So anyway, moving us on, because we could all talk about Elon Musk and his madness for a long time, to another story that is indeed. So, you know, on the other hand, don't stop being so crazy, Elon. We'd have nothing to talk about. So in another story somewhat connected to the world of advertising transparency, YouTube has released news that they are going to be rolling out new rules on the platform for the use and application of AI tools that are typically used by content creators to make realistic looking videos. So content creators on the platform will now have to disclose if they're using those generative AI tools to create what they sort of define as altered or synthetic videos, and they're going to face fines if they don't comply with those new rules. So the changes come into force next year, and it means that videos will come with labels and prominent warnings if they contain AI altered images, particularly if they fit into that criteria and are videos containing or discussing sensitive content and information. And, you know, I think YouTube's statement was very much around, we're excited about AI and all of the amazing things that it can do from a creative point of view, but we feel really strongly about protecting the safety of all of our consumers on the platform. Consumers will also be able to request the removal of AI-generated videos if they depict an identifiable person or an identifiable voice, and that is also then extended to, you know, recording artists. So anyone that's mimicking singing or rapping or anything that is produced originally by a recorded artist will also, those sorts of, that kind of content will also come up against the ability to have that removed. So the question that I've got for the both of you here is are these rules actually going to have a meaningful impact on the way that AI tools are being used to generate, you know, to mimic real life, or to mimic, you know, genuine, realistic looking videos and content? And if these sorts of rules will have an impact, how do you think then that's going to have an impact on the use of AI tools in a general sense in the creative context of video and audio? So I'm going to start with you, John. What do you think about the rules and the concept of regulating AI in a video platform like YouTube? Is this a good step? Is this a good step that YouTube are taking? Are they being firm enough, fast enough?
I think it's a good step. I think it's an important step, particularly when we're talking about, you know, the creation of events that never happened. I think that's very important that that's labeled as created, AI generated. I think in terms of copyrights, and, you know, protecting artists whose music's being duplicated through AI and recreated, I think having a labeling really needs to help. We need some definition between what is a real artist and monetizable created song for an artist versus an AI duplication. That I think it's a good step. Whether it's fast enough is a different question. I'm not sure whether the horse has indeed bolted already before we've got to this stage. AI and generative AI content is absolutely here to stay and is, you know, actually incredibly popular. I was sent some research by an agency called Billion Dollar Boy this week who have found out that 4 in 5 creators have reported favorable engagement on AI created content, which is incredibly interesting. But I do think, yeah, in terms of the copyright side of things and the creation of fictional events through AI, there really does need to be some labeling and some standardization.
It's interesting because we talked about this connected to out of home advertising and marketing recently, that there'd been a sort of a swathe of out-of-home campaigns that were being criticised for using AI tools and depicting events that hadn't actually happened in real life. So there was a tube train carriage that had these giant, it was a Maybelline campaign, had these giant eyelashes attached to it. And the social posts from the campaign made it look like there really was a tube train out there somewhere that had these things attached to it. Of course, they hadn't. And, you know, we were talking about the value of that and the morality associated with it. I feel like, you know, and John, you and I have had an experience this week in the office looking at some fantastic AI tools connected to video, in fact, that just made us go, wow, that can do that. That's amazing. So I feel the sort of, you know, the conflict between being excited by it, but making sure that we know that it's not real. Richard, what's your point of view, especially working with all the brands that you work with? You must be having so many conversations about AI and not just its impact on the creative process, but, you know, what your brands feel about the creative output and AI.
Yeah, we are having conversations with our clients about AI, actually. At the moment, most of them are very cautious because you don't really know where your prompts and data are going once you put it into most generative AI tools. So, and a lot of our clients have products that we have to work with on NDA because they don't want information to come out. So that kind of precludes us using those kinds of tools on that work. But I'm quite conflicted about this news on YouTube, actually, because on one hand, yes, it's definitely positive, right? I mean, on one end, you've got those fantastic Brian Monarch videos of Arnold Schwarzenegger singing Yellow by Coldplay, which are fantastic deep fakes and hilarious. But John makes a really good point that, you know, in terms of depicting events that haven't happened, and we've seen that already in previous election campaigns in the States, it's really important that those things are flagged. However, I think if you're creating a false historical narrative using AI, you're not going to flag it anyway. And unless Google can pick this stuff up automatically with some kind of smart AI of their own, it's still going to get through. But for me, this kind of signifies a different... I think it may be the beginning of a new kind of maturity for creative platforms like YouTube, because YouTube is a perfect example of a participation brand, which is why I said, you know, we wish we could have built YouTube, because it exists because people make things for it. It's brilliant. But this for me feels like a significant shift from, they've always said what you can and can't put on the platform. Okay. But this is now starting to impinge on how you create that thing that appears on their platform. And it also comes at the same time when they are releasing information about DreamTrack, their own AI music creation tool, where you can use artists' voices that they have licensed to create your own unique music for your YouTube short. So it kind of feels a little bit like, well, you know, we really want you to be very cautious and flag using AI on our platform, unless it's our AI, and then go for it, go down, busters. But at least they have arranged copyright and they have paid these artists for the right to use their voices. And that is a fundamental difference. But I do think that it's a slight shift in the relationship for the creator community. I mean, not the massive ones like Linus Media Group. They'll still carry on doing what they're doing, creating original content that doesn't necessarily use AI. But I think there's a whole group of independent solo creators who are starting to get on the bandwagon and explore the tools that AI are giving them. And they're not going to have an outlet for it anymore.
I wondered if them. You know, I had hopes that you would bring us a sort of a creativity angle that we hadn't really thought about in depth before, because I wondered about that a little bit. You know, because if I think about it from my point of view, the sorts of AI tools that we're talking about that would help create specific videos of things that haven't happened before could be really beneficial, because we're not actually, you know, that's not our day job. It's not our day job to create stuff. It's our day job to maybe produce the output, but not necessarily to do the creative stuff. And if it's stuff that we could do using an AI tool, that's great. You know, we already do it with some images on some of our site content, you know, which we've used Midjourney for and other AI tools. And, you know, we love playing around with it, but it's not the same thing as actually creating something from scratch, being the artist or the singer or the creative, you know, director in an agency that is tasked with sitting down, coming up with the concept and the idea and all of the things that input into that. And I suppose that, you know, beyond what the rules that YouTube's creating here, it starts to get us into a bit of a debate about who really creates. What is creation of original stuff anyway? You know, if I row back a few years, a good friend of mine from school is a film score composer. And so he's been in the business of creating music his whole life. And sometimes that music is created digitally and sometimes it's actually recorded with an orchestra in a studio environment. So he does a bit of everything. But he talked to me about how much digital input or overlay has been involved in the creation of recorded live music anyway. So an orchestra is not a good example, but a singer is a great example. And he's talked about working with singers before who might be great singers but are having an off day, or might be shit singers and they have to get something recorded, and the digital tools will pitch correct every single flat note or sharp note that they push out. Now, does that mean that that person hasn't created, you know, the singer hasn't actually sung the song? Does it mean that all of the digital tools have done it for them? I don't know. You know, and so I think there's a real extension of that debate: is where does that creative process start and where does it stop in terms of human input, and then how do AI tools and any tech tools help us take that over? And then I think as well that the line comes with understanding what it is that we're consuming. So from the point of view of YouTube, the rules, I suppose, are their effort to ensure that there is some guardrails around what isn't on the platform. But like you said, Richard, they've already had those guardrails in place for a long time. And so the wider question is, are those actually going to stop the generation of false, incorrect, inaccurate content, or content not being flagged as being created by AI tools and being used for nefarious purposes?
Yeah, as I said, I don't think it will stop it, because if you're doing it for nefarious purposes, you don't really care about declaring how your work was created. You just care about having an impact on, you know, making the bubble that you're shouting into even more toxic, for example. I think that, speaking from an advertising creative's point of view, a marketing creative's point of view, it's a little bit of a nest of vipers at the moment. At one level, yeah, great. Something like Stable Diffusion or Midjourney is a great tool for getting visual work done quickly to help establish an idea, or to sell an idea into a client, or sell an approach into a client. At the moment, those tools, even if you're paying for the paid version of those platforms, they're not quite ready to do the high quality work that we have to do for our clients just yet. But it won't be long, and it certainly won't be long in terms of video either. In terms of, I guess a lot of it comes down to ownership, right? So who is paying? From an ad agency point of view, who is paying? Forgive me if I'm rambling, but I saw a video today on YouTube, funnily enough, about copyright and AI. And at the moment, US law, which is kind of the model for most US patent, for global patent law, is no human intervention, no patent is available. You can't copyright that work. Because they were talking to a scientist, I think he might have been at MIT, who has created an AI bot that is self-creating. It's now having virtually no input from humans whatsoever, and is creating original works. But US law says that they can't be
patented.
Exactly.
Yeah.
From a commercial creativity point of view, which is what I do, I guess, are clients willing to pay for the ownership of work that is generated by an AI platform beyond some prompts, which is where we are at the moment? And I think at the moment, no. I think clients want work that is completely original and totally ownable. And if it's done by an AI, it isn't particularly, because you can get close to it yourself. But I think that view might have to change within 18 months, 2 years, particularly when we start getting into really good video output, high quality video output that you could watch on a cinema screen or on a 4K TV or an 8K TV. So I think we're quite early on. I feel sometimes like we're a bit like Crest toothpaste, the first commercial that ran on ITV in 1953 or something, whatever it is. We're kind of there in the development of this as a commercial tool. And I'm really interested to see where it goes, and also slightly frightened.
Yeah. John, what's your point of view on that? Because I sort of think, you raise an interesting point there, Richard, about what clients are willing to pay for. And a really basic sort of comparator is think about the early days of more sophisticated desktop publishing tools, like, you know, anything in the Adobe suite. And once you would always pay, a specialist to knock that sort of stuff up for you. But then you realize that you could get Adobe on your own laptop and maybe you could do it a bit yourself. But then what ended up happening is you don't have the time. You're not really the right person for that job. So you wind up going back to a specialist who can end up doing it for you. John, do you see maybe a similar sort of journey when it comes to potentially using AI? I mean, we're talking about it in the context of AI producing creative outputs. Could you imagine that?
Yeah, I think, we've already seen roles develop through generative AI. We're talking about prompt engineers now. I know we discussed that on the podcast last week with Sonia David from Dentsu. But yeah, that's like Richard said about the creative side of things. There's that development there that we are going to need. We need the guardrails, and also it opens up professionalism for use of AI. So maybe that's the way it goes, maybe we're looking down the line at subscription services, and dedicated AI agencies. It's really interesting. And I can only echo what Richard said about being excited/frightened. Totally agree.
Yep. It feels like a good way to describe our lives on a day-to-day basis at the moment. And further to that, let me move us on to the third news story, which is entertaining, if nothing else. CEO of OpenAI, who is the developer of ChatGPT, one of the AI tools that I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast will be very familiar with, was sacked last Friday and looks as though he's going to be reinstated possibly in time for this Friday. So he was sacked as a result of allegedly not communicating openly with the board that oversees the non-profit parent company of which OpenAI is a commercial subsidiary. And his return to this role of CEO is contingent upon the removal of that board. So we understand, according to news sources and specifically an article that appeared on The Guardian, I think yesterday, that there's lots of negotiations going on about who will take up those new board seats. But the principal idea is that obviously massive disagreement between Sam Altman and the existing board, the company, the employees who all went on strike and refused to work until he was reinstated. And indeed, Microsoft, who's one of the big investors in the company, also wanted to see his return or wanted him to be somehow involved in the future of all of the business associated with OpenAI. So it looks as though they'll get their way. Rumor has it, and this is just rumor and conjecture, that Altman was unpopular with the board because he was spending some of his time fundraising for another commercial entity. That it's not necessarily been confirmed, but there was clearly something going on there. And the one of the other accusations, or not accusations, I suppose, pieces of conjecture were that was that. The board were concerned about the rapid pace of AI development, I suppose akin to what we've just discussed in our previous news article, and evidently felt that Sam Altman wasn't paying enough attention to those concerns and thereby exhibiting the appropriate amount of leadership within the organisation. What I would like to know from the two of you, what do you think about this story? It is a crazy world over there in Silicon Valley. How much power and control do these chief executives have? How much don't they have? What was the board trying to do? What is Sam Altman up to? Fascinating that all of the staff was in such unity behind him. And what does that say about OpenAI and perhaps where that company is going to go? So coming to you first on this one, Richard, what's your point of view?
Oh, so much tech bro drama.
Yeah. I just when you thought there wasn't any left, right?
Oh, there will always be tech bro drama. That's the fundamental nature of tech bros. So if I were Microsoft, I'd be pretty nervous about this because even though he may have been backed by almost all of the staff at OpenAI, it just feels to me like you've just given him an awful lot more power than he even had before. And I don't know Sam Altman, I've never met him. I'm sure he's great company, but this for me just really smacks of the kind of hubris that we see so often from people who think they're smarter than everybody else and probably are smarter than everybody else. I mean, same Bankman-Fried saying that all young people are smarter than all old people. And that, because that was his frame of reference, is exactly the same kind of thing. It's the kind of overestimation of your own powers. And this smacks to me a little bit of that. It's interesting what you said about him being self-serving, perhaps, and looking at other opportunities. I read some similar stories, and he was trying to do something in hardware to kind of till some of NVIDIA's thunder. But he was fired from a startup incubator firm called Y Combinator for the same kind of reasons. So if those rumours are true, and they are only rumours, then it looks like there's a slight pattern occurring here. I think the only people that need to worry about this really are Microsoft, because they are in with both feet. Copilot is going to be so important to them that they need it to work really well, and OpenAI are the power behind that. So I think in the end, I mean, you asked me on the show notes, how big a deal is this really? Probably not that much. Is the Brave AI future in good hands? Probably not.
What this story sort of somewhat says to me is that, firstly, obviously we're not getting the behind the scenes picture here of what's actually going on at OpenAI and what type of a leader Sam Altman is, and what and how the company is being motivated, how the workforce are being motivated, treated, etc. But my heart does sink a little bit every time we see one of these ad tech bro dramas, as you described them, Richard, because I just think, could people stop behaving like this? Like, why can't you just, I don't know, run a company, do your job, get on with the business? And I just, and you're right, you know, maybe there is some exceptional level of intelligence. Would Tesla have been built without Elon Musk? Would OpenAI be where it is without Sam Altman? But they don't possess all of the intelligence, otherwise they wouldn't find themselves in these shoes, you know, and they will argue that there is a reason that they behave in this way. But I would argue that there's usually smarter people behind these people that are actually getting on with the job and doing the work. I don't know. John, what do you think?
It was just quite an interesting few days to see the tech world. I mean, it always considers itself to be the center of everything, but the tech world to really kind of disappear into itself and get sucked into this boardroom drama. You know, people, it was a real life Succession, and people casting all sorts of stories around what was going on, and he's in and he's out, and then he's in again, and he's in Microsoft. And it's, you know, the drama side of it's quite fun to watch it play out. It speaks a lot to, like, the cult of personality involved in these leadership roles. And, you know, that's when you've got almost an entire staff of 700 people signing a letter to back you and have you reinstated. There is, like Richard said, there is now an incredible power involved with that in for Sam Altman in OpenAI. I would like to spare a thought for Emmett Shear, who was CEO of OpenAI for 72 hours. And you know, it did a great job by all accounts in those 3 days to steady the ship.
He didn't let it burn down.
It survived. I think this is where the interest in the story lies for me, is where the real argument was, and the discussion between the acceleration that Sam Altman is, you know, responsible for in OpenAI and also pushing for, and then the reaction of the board to bring in a more cautious man like Emmett Shear, who's on the record as saying that we are proceeding at a rate of 10 at the moment, and I'd rather it was a 1.2, I think, is a vague resemblance of a quote of him. He's talked about establishing the bounds of safety for AI, and this is probably where the meat is of the story for me, whether it came about because we are proceeding rapidly without caution, and they thought perhaps a little more was needed. So, in terms of, you know, the Brave AI future, I'm wondering how this will play out now that the accelerant is back in charge.
And that's the concern, right, is putting too much power into the hands of someone that is not, democratically elected, shall we say. It just doesn't feel right. We wonder why things go wrong when we do that. And because we don't know what what the sort of checks and balances are in place. We do. The checks and balances that were in place was the board that was overseeing this. And so on being sacked, there is a maneuver that somehow results in the entire workforce saying we're not coming into work unless you reinstate. And then that person that's been sacked saying, well, I'm not going to take that job again unless you get rid of everybody that disagreed with me and everyone that disliked me. And that just does not feel comfortable at all. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what sort of commercially viable organization would think that's a good way to run. But on the other hand, you know, maybe because we don't know, maybe it's just that he's, you know, great guy, great leader, great boss. Everybody believes in his vision and it's a great place to work. And yeah, exactly. It's hard to imagine that, right? And also too, I'm sort of deeply suspicious of the pace of acceleration in some of these things because, you know, if you've got someone else, you know, like the interim CEO saying, we're accelerating too fast. Not only are we accelerating too fast, it's not twice as fast. It's like 10 times as fast as I think we should be accelerating. Then there should be a middle ground somewhere. You can't go from, right, we're sacking you, putting you in, who thinks we should be doing the absolute opposite. Oh, no, we're going to go back to reinstating you. But anyway, I guess, like you said, Richard, it's Microsoft that really, you know, in the hot seat here. And so who else is going to get in his way? No one.
Well, this yeah. And I mean, we can only hope this new board are at least grown-ups.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got Bret Taylor, former co-CEO of Salesforce, at least brings some experience of running a very, very big company into this, which won't hurt. But then there's also Adam D'Angelo stays on the board to represent the views of the old board. How does that actually work?
Exactly.
To sit there and go, well, we wouldn't have liked that, and everyone else ignores him, or I just don't get that role. It seems very strange.
I don't at all understand their board governance. I mean, you know, in any of the boards I've been involved with, it can't go like that. So, I don't understand how they've got that sort of, yeah, how they've squared that away.
Yeah.
It does make me feel like, you know, Silicon Valley is a little sub planet where none of the normal rules that apply to everybody else exist. And,
I mean, they've normalized being a chairman and a CEO as well, haven't they? Have you noticed that, tech companies?
Yeah.
Where that used to be two very distinct roles that performed very
Indeed.
Different functions on a board.
Yeah.
And that's not just Silicon Valley. That goes all the way out to Redmond. And I find that staggering that's become a thing now.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I guess, you know, we could say that a lot of these companies and their board structures have been organized such usually for financial purposes, right? So it's to suit someone that's involved in the funding chain there somewhere. And that's worked for a long time. But I just wonder if we're entering a new era of business where that doesn't work as smoothly anymore. And that, you know, even funders and investors and financiers are becoming far more interested in exactly how companies are being built, run, managed, organized. And then don't forget that I hope that we're living through a time where businesses, you know, think about all of that stuff that cropped up in the early days of Musk taking over Twitter, of staff sleeping in the office and all of that sort of nonsense, right? I hope we're living through a time where that shit cannot happen. And if it does, somebody's willing to speak up about it. And I feel like that will sort of get in the way of the way that businesses and companies are managed, run and organized, because that's the sort of bad stuff that happens usually when there's one person in control and who can do whatever they want.
Yeah. Like the old Victorian and business magnates who started, you know, businesses that we all know and love, like railways across America and, you know, but funded or built by Chinese slaves and things like that. I mean, the Victorians didn't know that when they installed lead piping, it would kill everybody, because that's because they didn't know. We live in an age now where,
you know,
it just seems like the people will do things because they can and don't take a moment to think about whether they should. And we're smart enough to be able to do that now, but it just doesn't happen.
That's absolutely a very good punctuation point on which to finish this podcast. We should be doing things not just because we can, but because we should. Fantastic. Thank you very much, Richard, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you as our special guest on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Our pleasure. And thank you very much, John. Lovely to have you in the hot seat.
No, thank you. Nice to be back on this side of the microphone.
Fantastic. And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.